Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with an analysis of the deep and revolutionary changes underway in the Middle East that the US government and media are not grappling with. Hilary Mann, who served as Middle East expert on the National Security Council under Presidents George W. Bush and Bill Clinton, joins us to discuss the fundamental flaws in US strategic policy in the region that has us mired in empire and blinded by our own virtue. Then we'll look into the extent to which, as Hillary Clinton suggested, the Arab Spring revolutions have traded the rule of tyrants for the rule of the mob, and examine Muslim sensitivities to religious provocation with Islamic scholar Ambassador Akbar Ahmed, the chair of Islamic Studies at American University and chair of Middle East and Islamic Studies at the United States Naval Academy. We will discuss his contention that America's war on terror has become a global war against tribal Islam. Then finally, we will discuss the war within Christianity here in the United States in this election campaign with Molly Worthen, a professor of history at the University of North Carolina. She has an article in Sunday's New York Times, The Power of Political Communion, and we will discuss the competing visions of Catholicism between the social gospel of Joe Biden and Nancy Pelosi, and the prosperity gospel promoted by Ayn Rand acolyte and conservative Catholic Paul Ryan. Joining us now is Hilary Mann Leverett, who is CEO of Strategic Energy and Global Analysis, Strategia, a political risk consultancy. She also teaches U.S. foreign policy at American University in Washington, D.C., and was a senior lecturer and senior research fellow at Yale University's Jackson Institute for Global Affairs. She was director for Iran, Afghanistan, and Persian Gulf Affairs on the National Security Council in the George W. Bush administration, Middle East expert on the Secretary of State's policy planning staff, and political advisor for Middle East, Central Asia, and African issues at the U.S. mission to the United Nations. From 2001 to 2003, she was one of a small number of U.S. diplomats authorized to negotiate with Iranians over Afghanistan, al-Qaeda, and Iraq. In the Clinton administration, Hillary also served as political advisor for Middle East, Central Asian, and African issues for the United States mission to the United Nations and associate director for Near Eastern Affairs at the National Security Council and special assistant to the ambassador at the U.S. Embassy in Cairo. She is co-author of the forthcoming book, Going to Tehran, Why the United States Needs to Come to Terms with the Islamic Republic of Iran, and the blog www.raceforiran.com. Welcome to Background Briefing, Hilary Mann Leverett.
Thank you for having me.
And today on Meet the Press, Benjamin Netanyahu, Prime Minister of Israel, said that some those advocating containment, I imagine that includes yourself, set a new standard for human stupidity. Specifically, he was saying that he's heard people saying in the American press, well, if you take action, that's a lot worse than having Iran with nuclear weapons. And people who say this have set a new standard for human stupidity. I haven't actually not heard that. Have you?
No, I haven't. I mean, the strange thing is I do think that containment is a problematic position for the United States, but what Netanyahu is trying to do is to box the United States in to not even have that as an interim option. But his words do sound a bit unprecedented, and it's striking how they come out so close to the U.S. presidential election coming up here just in about 6 weeks.
But what people have said is that if you strike Iran, then that will likely give them more of an incentive to get a nuclear weapon, and nobody in the intelligence community says they have one.
Nobody in the intelligence community here in the United States, and even more importantly for this point, no one in the intelligence community in Israel says that they have a are producing nuclear weapons, or that the supreme leader of Iran has even decided to produce nuclear weapons. And in fact, all of the indicia that we have, all of the statements out of Iran, out of the supreme leader himself, all of their past behavior would indicate that they have not, they have decided actually not to produce nuclear weapons. So it is really an astounding line of reasoning to put forward today by Prime Minister Netanyahu.
And, of course, there's been a lot of speculation in the Israeli press about an attack on Iran prior to the elections. And now a group of very distinguished Americans in national security have come forth with a study weighing benefits and costs of military action against Iran. Former national security advisors Brent Scowcroft, Zbigniew Brzezinski, and former Undersecretary of State Tom Pickering and retired General Anthony Zinni. What do you make of their paper?
Well, and this is where I get back to the issue that I think containment is not not only not an appropriate, but not a workable policy for the United States, even in the medium term. Because pursuing a policy of containment, which is largely what this new paper by these national security experts puts forward, is a policy to try to keep Iran in a box, to try to keep these rising powers, including the Islamic Republic of Iran, but Islamist movements throughout the Middle East. And it's an attempt to keep them in a box and to preserve a status quo ante that the United States enjoyed when it had a balance of power in the region that was much to its favor. But that balance of power rested on, I think, an over and done with situation where the United States could basically pay for, arm, and support dictatorships throughout the region in its pursuit of dominance there. That's over. That really collapsed with the repeated policies, particularly under the Bush administration, of invading Iraq, invading Afghanistan, and the continuing policies that President Obama has put forward. We can no longer pursue this policy of dominance, I would even call it hegemony in the Middle East, without real blowback. And we are going to see that from Iran. We're going to see that from various Islamist movements in countries that we think we helped liberate. I should say, quote-unquote liberate, like Libya and Egypt, where populations will rise up and say, no, it wasn't the United States that helped liberate us. In fact, it was the United States that kept us down for years, and we are now rising up in part to assert our independence. That is happening throughout the region, and that will continue to come from the Islamic Republic of Iran, even more so as we try to press it through increasing sanctions, if not even more overt military means like an attack.
Again, I'm speaking with Hilary Mann Leverett, who was Director for Iran, Afghanistan, Persian Gulf Affairs on the National Security Council in the George W. Bush administration, had similar posts in the Clinton administration, and is the co-author of the forthcoming book, Going to Tehran, Why the United States Needs to Come to Terms with the Islamic Republic of Iran, and the blog www.raceforiran.com. Now, nothing, I think, illustrates us being out of step with reality than the efforts on both on the part of the United States and particularly on the part of Israel to stop Ban Ki-moon from going to the non-aligned summit in Tehran recently. And as you've pointed out, Hilary Mann Leverett, the president of Egypt, before he has even come to the United States, his first trips were to Iran recently and to China. So you're saying the train has left the station. They're going on with their own business without us. And if we want to get into the act, we're going to have a different dialogue. Is that what you're saying?
Yes. And this is a very, very difficult point from which the United States must pivot. We have been able to push what we call our cards in the Middle East, our economic aid to various governments and our military assets to try to force outcomes in each of these places throughout the Middle East. That is becoming less and less possible. The limits of that, of the constructive impact of that, have been on graphic display in Iraq and Afghanistan throughout the region. With that, we have to pivot to policies that actually try to engage with rising movements, groups, and governments in the Middle East instead of trying to force outcomes. The debate now in Washington is not only about trying to coerce an outcome out of Iran vis-a-vis its nuclear program, but it's a debate increasingly about how to coerce the new president of Egypt to deal with his own domestic politics. That is a train that has left the station. If we want to have any influence in these countries for them to align with us where they can, where it's in their interest to do so, we have to start speaking to them and with them about common interests, mutual interests, and working with them in that regard, and not trying to force them to adopt policies that are against their interests.
Well, I'm sort of reminded, Hillary, of those cheesy old Westerns where the Indian chief says white men talk with a forked tongue. the notion that so much of, I think, what compromises our position in the Middle East, particularly in terms of encouraging the Arab Spring and the democracy, et cetera, is our reliance on fossil fuel. And you're, of course, CEO of Strategic Energy and Global Analysis, Strategia. Isn't that the heart of our problem, is that we're addicted to Saudi crude?
Well, it's very interesting. I would put it in terms of we have two commitments in the Middle East that we want from the Middle East that are very difficult for Middle Easterners to swallow. And that is we want the reliable, cheap supply of crude oil to our markets, not only to our markets, but we want to decide actually who gets it at what price. So not just to the United States and to Europe, but we want to have a say to make sure whether or not we want it to go to China or India or other competing powers. We want to control and dominate that decision-making in the Middle East in terms of our own power. We've done that since World War II. You know, we don't become a net importer of oil until the 1970s. So for the interim period from the end of World War II, from 1945 until the 70s, our interest and pursuit of dominance in the Middle East and control over those oil resources was not primarily about getting oil to market in the United States. It was primarily about getting oil to market in Germany and Japan to enable those recoveries, to bind those states to us in terms of security commitments, and to ensure that we, in the new global world order after World War II, decided who would get it and who perhaps wouldn't get it if they crossed us. So the oil issue is an interesting one. It's not just about fueling the U.S. economy. It's very much about global economic power and therefore global political power. And that's not something that we've ever really asked the Arabs to buy into and to work with us on as equal partners. It's something that we want for our own power. That's hard for them to swallow. The other issue that's difficult for them that we pursue in terms of our dominance is our support for Israel. That is something that they have opposed, you know, clearly since the establishment of the state, and even more so since 1967 when Israel seized Arab territory. In part, our support of dictators like in Egypt is about that. Our support of 30 years of dictatorship under Mubarak and before him under Sadat is about our commitment to Israel over the objections of the largely Arab and largely Muslim populations around Israel that are so angry and so resentful of Israeli policies. Because of those two issues, our support of Israel and our desire for control over oil resources, it has meant we cannot, and I would posit we will not, genuinely support democratic political participation in the Middle East, because the outcome will be governments that actually respond to the interests of their people, which is not to have unconditional support of Israeli policies and is not to have oil flow at the price and reliability that the United States wants.
Well, I think nothing illustrates our demise more graphically than the difference between Bush 1 and Bush 2. Bush 1 conducted a war against Saddam Hussein, which in effect did exactly what you said. It renewed the U.S. as the hegemon in terms of that part of the world over the global supply of oil. And his son, George W. Bush, in his reckless misadventure, seems to have undone it. I mean, we're a spent force, aren't we? We're not that relevant anymore in the Gulf. I mean, not to mention the fact that we've got a huge naval deployment there now, but
yes, and the problem is that what Americans have a very, very hard time coming to terms with is that this use of military power, hard power, is becoming less and less relevant to determine outcomes for each issue and in each country that we have these important interests. Now, in part, Bush 41 does really renew the United States' role in the Middle East, role in the world, at a critical time at the end of the Cold War, the collapse of the Soviet Union, in ways that were quite extraordinary for presidential leadership anywhere in the world. But there was one, I would argue, fatal mistake that his administration pursued, and it was one in part out of maybe exuberance, maybe arrogance, the end of the Cold War, the collapse of the Soviet Union. When we could have withdrawn our troops in 1991 after ejecting Iraq's troops from Kuwait, we could have withdrawn them. We could have gone home, or we could have reverted back to an over-the-horizon posture. We instead decided to keep tens of thousands of American troops in Saudi Arabia the heartland of the Muslim world with no exit strategy. People here in Washington said, oh, it'll be just like Korea or just like Germany. We would be able to assert that kind of on-the-ground dominance or hegemony. That was a fatal flaw in strategy and something that really set a lot of these trends in motion. And, of course, when his son, George Bush, the 43rd president of the United States, comes into office, he's not nearly as adept as at his father and really pursues on the ground, in your face, hegemony that I think Arabs and Muslims just cannot countenance.
So obviously, in many ways, it's the footprint itself that's the problem for the United States in that part of the world. But there's also a Cold War going on, is there not, Hilary Mann Leverett, between Saudi Arabia and Iran? And in many ways, it seems that if you pull back and look at it as objective as you can, that perhaps we've picked the wrong side. You know, we are wedded to medieval Wahhabism and a very corrupt reactionary regime in Saudi Arabia. And as much as we vilify the Iranians, I'm not sure that they're anything near as bad as our allies, the Saudis.
And that is really one of the points of the book I've co-authored that's forthcoming in January, that the Islamic Republic of Iran presents Iran itself, before even the Islamic Republic, has always been a strategically critical country for any external power to have a relationship with. We understood that. President Nixon in particular understood that very, very clearly. The problem that was posed by the Islamic Republic to the United States starting in 1979 was not that they couldn't have a relationship with the United States, but they would only have a relationship with the United States that would preserve their independence, their absolute independence. That has been something the United States has been unwilling to deal with. Saudi Arabia gives us, it seems on the surface, an easier option. We don't have to accept Saudi independence. We can put troops in Saudi Arabia. We can tell Saudi Arabia what to do with oil. We can tell Saudi Arabia what to do in terms of pegging their currency to the dollar. There are a lot of things we can do with the Saudis. Now, many of those have really come back to hit us hard, but we are still somehow entranced by the apparent ease of a relationship with a country that is willing to cede some of its sovereignty to the United States, but clearly its citizens don't agree with. And that's why many people in Al-Qaeda, that's why 15 of the 19 hijackers on 9/11 were Saudi. Not because Saudis are bad people, but because they're so angry that their government has ceded so much of their independence to an external power.
So how can we call for the removal of Mubarak in Egypt and not the removal of the Saudi kings?
Well, I think it was in Egypt, it was really because it was a fait accompli at the end of the day. When there were the protests in Egypt and it started to become clear that those protests were going to overwhelm the Mubarak government, initially the response from Washington was, well, Vice President Biden said Mubarak's not really a dictator because he's friends with Israel. Secretary of State Clinton gave the touching statement that the Mubaraks, both President Mubarak and Mrs. Mubarak, are personal friends of our family. It wasn't until it was absolutely clear that Mubarak was going to be overthrown that we tried to engineer his replacement with Omar Suleiman, his Minister of Intelligence, who ran the rendition program that took American Egyptians and other Egyptians back to Egypt to be tortured as part of our war on terror. It wasn't until then that we tried to engineer Suleiman's replacement of Mubarak, and when that didn't work, we finally welcomed the ouster of Mubarak and the replacement of a democratic process of transition. That is something that Egyptians see and understand. The problem is here in the United States, people don't see and understand that at all. Here in the United States, for example, USA Today ran an article in the last day or two that expressed real amazement that Egyptians could be scaling the walls of the American embassy in Cairo and hoisting what looked like to be Al-Qaeda flags on the embassy, amazement that Egyptians could be doing that when they should really be grateful that the United States liberated them from the Mubarak regime. This is really an American indulgence. It's a real American indulgence in delusion that we got away with for many years after the collapse of the Soviet Union. But today, when powers are rising, not just China and India, but inside the Middle East itself, we are not going to get away with for much longer.
Well, Hillary Mann Leverett, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Thank you very much for having me.
Again, I've been speaking with Hillary Mann Leverett, who's the CEO of Strategic Energy and Global Analysis, Strategia, a political risk consultancy. She teaches U.S. foreign policy at American University in Washington, D.C., and was a senior lecturer and senior research fellow at Yale University's Jackson Institute for Global Affairs. She was director for Iran, Afghanistan, and Persian Gulf Affairs at the National Security Council in the George W. Bush administration, Middle East expert on the Secretary of State's policy planning staff, and political advisor for Middle East and Central Asian and African issues at the United Nations mission to the at the U.S. mission to the United Nations. And from 2001 to 2003, she was one of a small number of U.S. diplomats authorized to negotiate with the Iranians over Afghanistan, al-Qaeda, and Iraq. And in the Clinton administration, she also was associate director of Near Eastern Affairs at on the National Security Council and special assistant to the ambassador at the United States Embassy in Cairo. She is the co-author of the forthcoming book, Going to Tehran, Why the United States Needs to Come to Terms with the Islamic Republic in Iran, and blogs at www.raceforiran.com. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back talking with Islamic scholar Ambassador Akbar Ahmed.
No one likes us, I don't know why. We may not be perfect, but heaven knows we try. But all around, even our old friends put us down. Let's drop the big one and see what happens. We give them money, but are they grateful? No, they're spiteful and they're hateful.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters. This is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Ambassador Akbar Ahmed, who is currently the Ibn Khaldun Chair of Islamic Studies at American University. He's the first Distinguished Chair of Middle East and Islamic Studies at the U.S. Naval Academy in Annapolis and a non-resident senior fellow at the Brookings Institution. He has advised General David Petraeus, Ambassador Richard Holbrook, and other U.S. agencies on Islam and foreign policy, and is the author of over a dozen award-winning books, including Discovering Islam, which was the basis of the BBC six-part TV series called Living Islam. His books, among them Journey into Islam, have been translated into many languages, including Chinese and Indonesian, and his latest project, Journey into America, is an unprecedented study based on fieldwork of Muslims in America. His latest book is The Thistle and the Drone, How America's War on Terror Became a Global War Against Tribal Islam. Welcome to Background Briefing, Ambassador Akbar Ahmed.
Thank you, Ian. Great to be back.
And it's good to talk to you again, Ambassador. And tell me, what's going on here in terms of, obviously this is a political election year here in the United States, but I was mystified, as you know, the reactions to Republican candidate Mitt Romney have been highly criticized in terms of his criticism of the Obama administration. And since then, of course, Mitt Romney has talked about how there are efforts underway to take God out of his heart and out of the public square in the United States. So as much as we're watching what's going on in the Middle East, there's also here in the United States a kind of strange theocratic debate going on. I'm not aware that anybody is trying in the United States is trying to take God out of anybody's heart or out of the public square. Are you?
No, I don't think anybody is. And I think, again, all these statements, Ian, I've been an observer of the scene for the last decade at least, and relating the scene here in the United States to what's happening in the Muslim world. Everything here is seen through the prism currently of the presidential elections, which means that what Romney says, Obama says, all their supporters say will in fact be based on their calculations of how those statements would affect that particular race, the race for the presidential elections. And therefore, these statements to out religion one another, out American one another, out patriotic one another, to show how enthusiastic and how correct they are, is simply a facet of that particular race. And that, of course, also affects how people look at events unfolding in the Middle East. Even the terrible tragedy which took the lives of so many American diplomats in Benghazi, including the ambassador who was such a devoted friend and supporter of Libya. Even that event is being interpreted exactly through this particular prism, which is the present election, with Romney and his supporters saying Obama has shown weakness, he should have been much stronger, he should have led from the front, and of course Obama's side saying that what he has done is correct and allows America to continue playing a role without getting too involved and bogged down as in Afghanistan.
So, Ambassador Akbar Ahmed, what did you make of Hillary Clinton's suggestion that the Arab Spring revolutions have traded the rule of tyrants for the rule of the mob?
Well, Ian, I would analyze it slightly differently. Democracy in the Arab world, and the Secretary is talking about the Arab world, and as a result of the what so-called Arab Spring, the Arab world has not really had a tradition of democracy. So you haven't had centuries of democracy in Egypt or Libya or Tunisia or Syria or any of these countries. And therefore, you have a time of dictatorship and then followed by democracy and then a period of adjustment between the two and eventually some form of genuine democracy. You literally are starting from scratch, which means that societies that have been so brutally repressed for decades. And this point needs to be driven home. Remember people like Gaddafi in Libya, Saddam in Iraq, Assad and his father in Syria. They've been ruling for literally decades, Mubarak in Egypt, 3-4 decades. Now, suddenly that rule, that authoritarian rule is removed, and ordinary people have no way of expressing themselves except going out into the streets. So there you have the problem of clan rivalry, religious rivalry, sectarian rivalry, and these men of violence who would promote violence for political purposes, Al-Qaeda and so on. So what you're seeing then is a very combustible mix while those governments attempt to create or form some kind of a normal running democracy. And this process is going to take some time. The danger here is a bigger danger, Ian, and that I see as a possibility. I hope I'm wrong, but the possibility that if things don't work out locally, you may have some ambitious young colonel in the Libyan army or air force or in Egypt, some general who may just say enough is enough and bring back the troops and declare martial law. And that whole cycle of military rule will start again and we are back to square one. So these are societies in transition, and tyranny has gone, mob rule for the time being, or aspects of it, mob rule are evident, and what is going to happen next needs to be very firmly put within the framework of all of us encouraging and wanting democracy, however noisy, chaotic, and even costly it is.
Well, Ambassador, ironically, of course, it was an attempt by reactionary forces in Egypt, but specifically Egypt's richest man, who was a crony of Mubarak's, who's a Coptic Christian who owns a television station. He was the one that was disseminating this video of this obscure film that nobody has ever seen. That helped spark this, and presumably his motives were to do exactly what you said, to bring back a kind of to say, look, the Muslim Brotherhood's not capable of ruling; they're an unruly mob, and therefore we need the discipline of the military. I mean, I'm assuming that was his motive.
Exactly, and I think there's right now the situation is confused. The public, the crowds can come out easily, and there's so much anger, and they start burning down things and throwing bricks and stones and things at government buildings. But we all have to step back and understand that there is normally a lot of confusion and lack of information in these events, in any revolutionary situation. And here it is particularly bad. So we are not really sure what exactly is happening, who's doing what to who, and we may only find out after some time. But as you said, you have to use your own intelligence and piece together, put connect the dots and say, if this is happening and so-and-so is involved, what would their motivations be? Who would benefit by what they're doing, the actions that they're taking? And you've analyzed it very well yourself, that those people who would like to discredit a government, if they encourage an action which causes so much anarchy and violence and killing and murder and so on, they would obviously benefit, because they would hope that some general, some man in uniform would simply say, all right, boys, enough is enough. Load your guns and get into the trucks and let's go and declare martial law. So there's always a danger of that kind of thing happening because of people designing it to happen.
Again, I'm speaking with Ambassador Akbar Ahmed. He's currently the Chair of Islamic Studies at American University in Washington, D.C., and the first Distinguished Chair of Middle Eastern and Islamic Studies at the U.S. Naval Academy in Annapolis, and a non-resident senior fellow at the Brookings Institution. His latest book is The Thistle and the Drone, How America's War on Terror Became a Global War Against Tribal Islam. I think, though, a lot of people here in the United States and in the West are having a hard time, though, understanding how easy it is, if that's the case, to provoke angry mobs through either the Danish cartoons or, in this case, this obscure movie that was so appallingly badly made that nobody in the world would want to see it. And yet, obviously, people are pushing it for their own Machiavellian reasons. But it has to be said that it was financed and promoted to a small degree by a group of religious Christian right bigots here in the United States. So answer that question, if you will, because I am getting a lot of mail on that very issue, is why are Muslims so easily offended?
But Ian, it's a very important question, and you're absolutely right. Americans are extremely concerned about how Muslims are responding. And I know, because I'm part of the debate in the media, I follow it carefully. They do feel that Muslims are oversensitive, and sometimes they feel that Muslims are not particularly rational in their responses, that they're violent, they're too angry, etc., etc. And there's an element of truth there. But there are several things that we need to, again, try to analyze in the situation. First of all, the responses, thankfully, there's no excuse for people being killed under any circumstances, but thankfully the responses have not been of hundreds of thousands of people. Whether it's Libya or Cairo, you're seeing a response which is limited to, I would say, hundreds rather than hundreds of thousands. Secondly, this is not something new. This is a response, I would say, Ian, that is linked to peoples, to nations who are extremely sensitive about certain things that symbolize what they hold dear in their society. So every society is sensitive about those things. Here in the United States, we may be sensitive about the flag, the stars and stripes. We may be sensitive about certain things that we believe symbolize the nation. In India, there would be a different kind of symbolism to represent the nation. In China, in Russia, each nation has something that is valued and they are really moved by, and it moves them to tears, as it were. Now, if those symbols, whether they are men, women, or monuments, or sacred objects, if those are attacked or perceived to be attacked, then people react. They react with unhappiness, with frustration, despair, and anger, and sometimes violence. This is not new, and this has happened. This is human history. Now, Muslims are very sensitive about two things. One is the Quran, the book of the Muslims, and the Prophet, who embodies the Quran for Muslims, the Prophet of Islam. And if you combine them, that really is the basis of faith. So when these are attacked deliberately, one is the routine attack, and Muslims have been facing that for over 1,000 years. But when these are attacked in an attempt to anger Muslims, Muslims very often respond exactly as people expected them to respond, which is with anger. It is, I'm afraid, a rather immature response, because for the last three decades, you mentioned the Danish cartoons. You could have mentioned Salman Rushdie's book, The Satanic Verses. For the last few decades, people have been provoking Muslims on exactly these issues, and Muslims have responded angrily. And unfortunately, tragically, people's lives have been lost. So you see how a nation or a people's response to symbols it holds very dear. These are the most valued, most precious symbols for Muslims, and it does provoke them. And my feeling here is, Ian, that we really need to be sensitive to each other. We appreciate the importance and absolutely crucial importance of freedom of press, and that must be maintained, freedom of expression that the West achieved after centuries of struggle, and it's incredibly important that we hold on to that concept. At the same time, even in the Supreme Court, the United States Supreme Court, it is accepted that you cannot enter a theater, a crowded theater, and start shrieking fire, because that will cause a stampede and people will be injured. And this kind of, you pointed out, the film made by certain people with the express purpose of provoking Muslims, this kind of action obviously is designed to create anger and then violence and then more hatred between communities, and you're upsetting some people and their faith. And I think we need to be much more sensitive than we are in the situation that we have found ourselves.
Well, just in the last minute, obviously the Arab Spring is causing the U.S. Foreign policy, shall we say, challenges. We have largely supported dictators, and we've said we want democracy, but now we haven't even begun to grapple with the enormity of the challenges we face as countries become more politically participatory and people have a voice. So, and also, just a quick comment on your new book about the global war against tribal Islam. I'm sorry, we've basically only got 30 seconds left.
Ian, we'll have another session.
I think we have to, yeah.
It's really an important book in the sense that I'm analyzing the war on terror through a very different angle, and that angle is tribal Islam, and looking at all these societies that are today involved in Afghanistan, Pakistan, Somalia, Yemen, in West Africa, and these all happen to be tribal societies. So I'm correlating the war on terror with tribal societies and the problems these societies face, the desperation, the economic poverty, and the chaos, the political chaos that is current in these societies. So it is a challenge for them, for those societies, and will continue to be one, and for us in the United States to understand those societies and see how we and they best could move towards a world which would be more peaceful and harmonious than it is at present.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here today, Ambassador Akbar Ahmed.
Thank you, Ian.
Again, I've been speaking with Ambassador Akbar Ahmed, who is currently the Ibn Khaldun Chair of Islamic Studies at American University. He's the first Distinguished Chair of Middle East and Islamic Studies at the United States Naval Academy and a non-resident senior fellow at the Brookings Institution. He has advised General David Petraeus, Ambassador Richard Holbrooke, and other U.S. agencies. He's the author of book, among them Journey into Islam, which has been translated into many languages, and his latest project is Journey into America, and which is an unprecedented study based upon fieldwork of Muslims in America, and his latest book is The Thistle and the Drone, How America's War on Terror Became a Global War Against Tribal Islam. We're going to take a brief station break, and then we're going to discuss the war within Christianity and Catholicism here in this election year.
Telling lies that you're not on your own.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Molly Worthen, who's a professor of history at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. She studies modern American intellectual life, particularly the history of evangelical Protestantism, and has an article in Sunday's New York Times, The Power of Political Communion. Welcome to Background Briefing, Molly Worthen.
Thank you.
And your article talks about the struggle, if you will, within the Catholic Church between what Vice President Joe Biden said at the Democratic National Convention, two different visions, two different sets of values, or, as you put it, the tale of two Catholicisms. Now, the fact that you have the bishops essentially supporting the Republicans and the nuns supporting the Democrats, how different is that from the general lay of the land in American politics, where 60% of women vote Democrat and 60% of men vote Republican? In other words, the Democrats are the mommy party and the Republicans are the daddy party.
Well, I would say that the Catholic vote is a very complicated vote, and it's hard to generalize. But historically speaking, there was once a time, as late as the 1960s, when a Catholic American was much more likely to vote Democrat than Republican. And what I tried to write about in the article is the story of the alienation of many Catholic Americans from the Democratic Party and the great tragedy of that, because there are so many theological ideas and there's a long intellectual tradition in Catholicism that very much supports and aligns with the Democratic platform of enhancing the social safety net and trying to guarantee a minimum level of physical security and dignity for all Americans.
Well, I guess the shift, as you point out in your article in Sunday's New York Times, The Power of Political Communion, Molly Worthen, is it started under Richard Nixon. I recall the hard hats joined with Nixon to condemn the anti-war demonstrators and beat a few heads, I remember. And then, of course, the Reagan Democrats were often working-class Catholic white males. How did the Republicans undo Jack Kennedy's base?
Well, they realized that there was this mass of working class, the term is often white ethnics, and that can be read often to mean a Catholic working class voters, perhaps the children of immigrants, who in the wake of the upheavals of the 1960s and 1970s felt that they had gotten a raw deal from America, that they were not achieving all they wanted to achieve, and in a political climate that had identified a number of categories of victims, be it black Americans or women, they had been left out. And on top of this, the Republicans capitalized on a backlash against the erosion of social mores and the social upheaval of the 60s and 70s. And on top of this, as the Democrats radicalized on the abortion issue, they lost interest in serious dialogue with those Christians, Catholic and evangelical, who perhaps had a great deal of sympathy for the Democratic social vision, but were not willing to grant that abortion ought to be legal, and that this was a fixed and closed conversation. And so there was both a radicalization on the part of the Democratic Party on this issue that is of core importance to many Catholics and Protestant evangelicals, as well as an increased savviness on the part of Republicans to really make a pitch to those religious voters who felt that they had been left out by elements of the Democratic message.
So, Molly Worthen, it would seem, though, that there's nowhere where you have greater concentration of conservative white Catholic men than on the Supreme Court. It's a pretty extraordinary situation, isn't it? Almost
yes.
The entire court is Catholic.
Yes, that's right. And some observers of the contemporary American political and intellectual scene commented that it almost seems as if Protestant evangelicals have outsourced much of their heavy-duty conservative intellectual thinking to Roman Catholics, and not least of which are those who are on the Supreme Court, who have so radically shifted our political culture in some of their recent decisions.
Again, I'm speaking with Molly Worthen, who's a professor of history at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. She studies modern American intellectual life, particularly the history of evangelical Protestantism, and has an article in Sunday's New York Times, The Power of Political Communion. Now, you would think, though, with the changing demographics in this country, that the Democrats would have an opening here. This is the first time in history that we haven't had white Protestants running for president of the United States, an uninterrupted tradition now with a black incumbent, Barack Obama, and a Mormon challenger. You've got about, I believe, about 10 million young Hispanics who have not registered to vote. Eventually they will. How would they split in terms of whether they would take the Paul Ryan, Ayn Rand approach or the Sister Simone Campbell social gospel approach?
Well, the data I've seen suggests that they are tentatively turning toward the Democratic Party, and that tends to be where they are aligning. However, it's a complicated story. And on the one hand, some commentators have pointed out that all the Democratic Party needs to do is wait a few years, a few more elections, and the white men in America will by that point be so outnumbered by new immigrants of color who naturally vote Democrat that the future elections will be in the Democratic Party's pocket. I think, however, that is an overly rosy vision, especially if the Democratic Party fails to understand the importance of religion to many of these new immigrants who perhaps are not fitting into the category of the traditional white conservative evangelical, but who are Roman Catholic or who are Pentecostal. The Pentecostal community is enormous among Hispanic Americans, and for them, they are wrestling with the tensions between their desire to support the Democratic agenda on issues such as immigration and the social safety net, but on the other hand, they are very genuine concern about traditional understandings of social mores, the abortion issue. And so if the Democratic Party does not learn to be sensitive to the interests of these constituents and the importance of religion, then they should not be overly confident about their ability to win those votes.
Well, I'm sure you recall, Molly Worthen, from the Democratic Convention, the moment where Mayor Villaraigosa of Los Angeles was calling the vote on changing the platform to include, to put God back in, and also the Jerusalem being the capital of Israel. And the A's had it, according to Villaraigosa, but there are an awful lot of strident no's coming from the audience there on the God issue. You're suggesting here that the liberal Catholics offer a path to secular Democrats who at the moment are failing to address the basic question of the human predicament. Elaborate on that.
Well, I'm suggesting that the liberal Catholics provide helpful interlocutors. They are conversation partners for secular Democrats who over the past couple of decades have become very alienated from religion in general. I think there is a hefty segment of the leadership of the Democratic Party that is in no small part because of the rising noise on the part of the religious right and the religious right's claim to sort of speak for all religious Americans, that they have become very uncomfortable with the presence of religion in the marketplace of American ideas generally and see it as a noxious force that quenches the freedom of individual conscience, that makes open public debate from commonly accepted assumptions impossible. And what I'm suggesting is that liberal Catholics, representing a population that has been a religious minority for a very long time, which cannot really be said of Protestant evangelicals who enjoyed a de facto establishment of their form of Christianity for most of American history up until probably about the 1970s. Liberal Catholics, on the other hand, have had to reason through the dilemma of being a religious minority among a frankly rather suspicious population that for much of Catholic history did not trust them, saw them as loyal only to Rome and not to American values. And therefore, they have become acutely and very intelligently sensitive to the compromises necessary to make a democracy work. And there is a tradition that Mario Cuomo called the American Catholic tradition of political realism that recognizes American democracy as an evolving conversation that needs to welcome people from religious perspectives, but can arrive at a working agreement, a consensus, that we need to continually revisit and talk about and argue about, but that provides some sort of common ground for living and arguing together as a community. And I see this liberal Catholic tradition as one that can be quite helpful to secular Democrats who are so leery of allowing people with a religious perspective into the conversation from the beginning. And I think, to take a practical example, the liberal Catholic discourse around the issue of abortion can perhaps help secular liberals reframe the way they make the case for legalized abortion to the American people. I mean, poll numbers keep coming back indicating that a small majority of Americans are leaning pro-life, and that is increasingly the trend. And my view is that the current line on abortion that you hear among secular Democrats, that we have to preserve Roe versus Wade as a bulwark against this war on women, is simply not resonating with the American electorate, for whom abortion is a deep moral tragedy. And they can learn to be more sensitive to the way in which most Americans think about this crucial issue, this issue that has so alienated secular and religious Americans from one another, by learning from those liberal Catholics in their own ranks who have had to come to terms with their party's support for Roe versus Wade on the one hand, and yet their own continuing personal opposition to abortion on the other.
Yeah, but also the majority of American Catholics practice contraception. And
that's right.
The conservative movement is trying to even outlaw contraception. Paul Ryan, the vice presidential candidate on the Republican side, is against contraception.
Well, I think that's a bit of a stalking horse. I think that is supposed to be a symbol, really, for attacking big government and defending what Ryan would call freedom of religion and his interpretation of the First Amendment against this secular, if not aggressively atheistic, Democratic Party. I don't think that behind closed doors, even Paul Ryan is under any illusions about what the poll numbers say about what Catholics and evangelical Protestants do in their own home. And certainly it's been the case for decades that both of those constituencies use contraception nearly as much, if not as much, as the population at large. But it's a very important symbolic battle over the relationship between the government and the individual and the place of religion in the public square.
But in practical terms, if you were to outlaw contraception, you would have more abortions.
I think that's not an unfair conclusion, right? And that's perhaps not one that he's wrestled with explicitly. But again, I see it as part of a broader rhetorical case that he's making that gets to very much what both parties are talking about when they talk about this election being a choice between two worldviews, two visions for the country. And Paul Ryan is trying to say that the Republicans stand for an America in which the government is in a very reduced role and the individual is free, and that freedom includes freedom to practice one's religious faith and impose one's religious faith on the public square in a very open and political way.
Well, just in closing, Molly Worthen, the religious right is clearly strident, powerful. They have a tremendous media outreach with televangelism and radio as well. So why is the religious left so dormant and the religious right so strident in this country?
It's a great and somewhat baffling question. I think the first thing to remember is that we cannot forget the great accomplishments of the religious left over the past century and the incredible role that liberal Christians, evangelical and Catholic, played in the civil rights movement. But that aside, there are a few reasons why the religious left does seem much more muted in our political debate today. I think, in general, Protestant evangelical Americans have suffered a sort of collective amnesia. They have forgotten their long heritage stretching across the whole of the 19th century, at which time evangelical Protestantism was deeply allied with social reform movements, with the desire to improve the life of the community and their fellow man, and somehow help to usher in the kingdom of God on earth. And what happened is, at the end of the 19th and in the early 20th century, that desire to reform society became allied with a certain liberal, what conservative evangelicals would call modernist ideas about reading the Bible, believing in the theory of evolution, and otherwise demoting the authority of the Bible. And so it almost became tainted. The reformist zeal that was such a crucial component of evangelical identity in the 19th century became tainted as liberal. And that's a great misfortune. More recently, the religious right has galvanized around this backlash against the social upheaval of the 60s and 70s, has drawn on this deep reservoir of anti-communism. And on the other hand, the religious left, since I would say the end of the civil rights movement as an organized political force, has been on the defensive, has been searching for any kind of comparable political energy, and has become, I would say, divided within itself for the same reasons that the American liberal movement in general has been split over questions of identity politics. And perhaps for religious people on the left, a kind of failure of nerve because of their sensitivity to other groups' truth claims, the sense that you see much more on the religious left than the right, that we have to be sensitive to the demands of a modern multicultural society, and this prevents them, perhaps, from being quite as ideological, quite as black and white in the way that so well serves the religious right when it comes to, you know, designing slogans for the culture wars.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here today, Molly Worthen.
Thank you for having me.
Again, I've been speaking with Molly Worthen, who's a professor of history at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. She studies modern American intellectual life, particularly the history of evangelical Protestantism, and has an article in Sunday's New York Times, The Power of Political Communion. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program's available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can also contact me. And I'll be back again tomorrow at 5 p.m. with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. Quiet voice.